The Olympics are going to be the death of me. Every night, have dinner, and then about the time that sane people start preparing to go to bed, I turn on the TV and start watching sports that during the previous 4 years, I haven't cared about. Don't get me wrong, the athleticism and skill of the Olympians impresses me, but during a normal summer, I don't care about gymnastics. It's true, I'm not saying it's not hard, but I just don't care. But during 2 weeks in August every 4 years, I stay up late just to make sure she sticks the landing. And then as I drag myself off to bed between midnight and 12:30, I start to grumble because I realize that I could catch the results in real time on my phone throughout the day. But there I am at 8 o'clock the next night, turning on the television to watch rowing. And right about that moment where I go, this is just not smart, I should go to bed and just check the results on my phone, it's at that moment that NBC gets me again, and they show one of those mini biographies on one of the athletes, and it's just like, oh, they got me again. I'm stuck. And maybe you've seen these, so you know the story of Yousef Mardini, a Syrian refugee who is competing as part of a refugee team, first time ever in the Olympics. And I don't know if you know her story. She and her sister and 18 other people were fleeing Syria. And as part of their fleeing, they got into a dinghy to go across a portion of the Mediterranean. And while they were out at sea, the boat breaks down. And she and her sister jump into the water and drag the boat behind them and swim over 3 miles to get them to safety. And then maybe you've heard about Rafaela Silva. She competes in judo for the host country, Brazil. And she's got a tattoo on the inside of her arm. And in Portuguese, it says this: God knows how much I've suffered and what I've done to get here. She was born and raised in the slums of Rio de Janeiro. And she worked her way up. And then 4 years ago, she competed in judo in London and just didn't do well. She crashed and burned, and instead of her host country just embracing her and saying, that's okay, we know how far you've come, instead she was just blasted on social media with racist comments. But she's back, and she competed again. Or maybe you've heard of Gour Mading Maker. He was one of the lost boys of Sudan. If you're not familiar with the lost boys of Sudan, during the Sudanese Civil War, an entire generation was wiped out, and this young man, along with some others like him, literally fled. They ran away. And they became known as the Lost Boys, and they ended up getting dispersed all over the world, the Lost Boys of Sudan. But this man who once ran from is now running for the country of South Sudan. And then maybe you've heard of Jillian Potter. She broke her neck, but she recovered only to get cancer. Then she overcame cancer, and now she's part of a 7-person rugby team. And I'm watching these mini biographies, and I'm reminded that beyond the patriotism and beyond the athleticism and the competition, the thing that draws me into the Olympics are the people. It's the stories and it's the people that draw me in. And I'm reminded when I watch these that people are important. Which takes us to where we're going to be this morning in the 14th chapter of Luke. We are in the middle of a series called Jesus Said, A Red Letter Summer. Every morning this summer, we're looking at the words of Jesus. And this morning, we're going to be looking at a lot of them. all in the 14th chapter. If you want to follow along in a Bible, there's Bibles in front of you, or if you brought them from home, we're going to be going through almost the entirety of the 14th chapter. You'll notice that almost the entire thing is red letters. It starts out this way, however. It said, one Sabbath, verse 1 of chapter 14 of Luke, one Sabbath when Jesus went to eat in the home of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. Okay, got to set the tone for the entire chapter right here. In the first century, to be invited into someone's home to break bread was to invite someone into intimate fellowship. Now, someone reading this in the first century, remember, Luke's gospel written in the first century, anyone that's reading Luke's gospel reads this and is appalled. Because Jesus has not been invited into a home to break bread for intimate fellowship. No, he's been invited into a home to be scrutinized. And this, for the first century reader, was appalling. And so if there is a soundtrack that you want to put with the 14th chapter of Luke, the soundtrack starts in a minor key. Look what happens next. There, in front of him, was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body. Some of your Bibles might have the word dropsy. You have an individual that is swelling. Old term would be dropsy. Dropsy would refer to someone that is retaining water and there's swelling and soft tissue and such. It was called dropsy. Today, somebody would see the condition and diagnose it as somebody who is suffering from congestive heart failure. So here's an individual, has a heart condition, and the result is he is swelling up. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, if one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out? Very specific question. You might find it to be odd, but it's a very specific question with a very specific intent. Because in Jewish culture in the first century, there are different portions of Judaism, sects in Judaism, and their interpretation of what was okay to do on the Sabbath differed among these different groups. For instance, the Essenes would say that you do nothing on the Sabbath. So if your ox were to fall into a well, too bad. You don't do anything to pick up the ox. The Pharisees, on the other hand, and remember, Jesus has been invited into the home of a Pharisee. The Pharisees were very clear that you're not supposed to do things on the Sabbath, but there were some exceptions. One of them was, if a child or an ox were to fall into a well, you could rescue them. This is why Jesus uses that very specific language. And so he asks them, is it okay to heal on the Sabbath? They don't say anything. He goes, huh. So you'd rescue an ox, but not this person. Your priorities are out of whack. You've made an ox more important than this human being created in the image of God. I love their response. They have this response often in this chapter. But they remained silent. They had nothing to say. So Jesus moves from this to some friendly advice. Although I don't know if they received it as friendly advice because it probably stung a bit. Verse 7, when Jesus noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. Okay, explain the table here. Chances are the table in this setting would have been a U-shaped table. Would have been common at that time and in that area. The place of honor would have been given to the guest. In this case, Jesus would have been at the head of the table, the bottom of the U. Then people would sit depending on their ranking. Go back to the Olympics. You have all the preliminaries for the 200 freestyle. I watched most of them. You have all the preliminaries. And by the time you get to the final, you've got 8 lanes, and the person with the best qualifying score gets right in the middle. And then the people go out depending on how they scored. Same idea. Person in the middle, the place of honor, they score the best in the eyes of society. And then you move out from there, the important people to less important people to, well, at least you get to eat with us. So here they are, and this is what happens. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. So they're all trying to get the best seat. So Jesus says this. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So Jesus gives them, hey, some friendly advice here to all of you wrestling for the best seat here tonight. Go to the lowest spot. Sit at the lowest place. The worst that can happen if you're sitting in the lowest place is you stay there. You don't have to move. But best case scenario, you get upgraded. This works. I love the way Paul says it in the second chapter of Philippians. He says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own self-interest, but also to the interests of others. This is what Jesus is saying here. He goes, go for the low spot. Go for the low spot always. It's a better idea. One, on a practical level, it works. But then he goes on and says, oh, and by the way, you're going to be blessed if you do it this way. It's just Jesus' way of saying, guess what? You follow my way of doing things. It works out well for you. It's good for you. Not always easy, but good. Try it, he says. Try doing it my way. You'll like it. The response. Oh, before the response. So Jesus gives some friendly advice. But then he says something a little more pointed. You think his little comment about, hey, go to the low spot, was harsh? Wait until you hear what he says next. Then Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So Jesus says, not only are your guys' priorities out of whack, as evidenced by the way you treated or didn't treat the individual that had the swelling, not only are your priorities out of whack, as evidenced by the way you fight for position around the table, but your guest list is flawed. You're inviting the wrong people. Where are the hurting? Where are the poor? Where are the blind? Where are the lame? Why aren't they invited? And again, he follows it up with this idea. He goes, by the way, if you do it this way, it's good. And it's good for you. You are fighting for things that hopefully you're hoping will raise you up. But in the long run, this other way is healthier for you. At this moment at the dinner, there's a lot of sandal staring. They're all just kind of doing this. And it's really quiet. Have you ever been in those places where there's this awkward silence? If you're in a group of people where there is this moment that it's silent for a good reason, there's always that one person that can't stand it and has to say something, and they rarely say something helpful. Yeah, I've been that person. Well, this person shows up now in the story. Jesus has just done three things in a row, and the room is just, oh. When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Hey, blessed are those who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." And you can just see the other people around the table. It's like, oh. Seriously, Bill? Oh, gosh. Jesus replied, and this has been labeled what he's going to reply as a parable. It's more of an allegory. An allegory being a story that you can link person and place to actual things. And so Jesus starts in here. And he says, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, "Come, for everything is now ready." Okay, we're going to pause for just a moment. We got a certain man. In this case, it's God. And God has prepared something amazing. And when he sends his son, Jesus Christ, he says, what we have been preparing for is here. And we have something worth celebrating. So he sends out his servant to go, okay, go tell all those that have been waiting for this. It's here. It's now. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, I have just bought a field and must go and see it. Please excuse me. Another said, I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. Still another said, I just got married so I can't come. The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame. Second time those categories have been used. He used them earlier in talking with the Pharisees. He's now repeated them. Go quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Sir, the servant said, what you have ordered has been done, but there is still room. Then the master told his servant, go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get to taste of my banquet. A couple different ways people have interpreted this parable, this allegory. So God has invited people to celebrate, to join in with what he is doing through his son, Jesus Christ. And the first group of people say, nope, not interested. The party that you're inviting us to isn't what we're really after. We'll do other things. Some people have interpreted that to be the righteous Jews, the Pharisees. Remember whose house he's in? These people that have studied the law and they're faithful followers, and then the banquet shows up. Jesus shows up. They go, we don't want to come to that. So then he says, go out into the alleys and the streets and bring in the herding. And some people have interpreted that to be, well, if not the righteous children of Israel, then the children of Israel that are on the fringes, bring them in. Now go out to the countryside. Some people have interpreted that to the Gentiles. Go. And it's not a bad interpretation. But I really, really appreciate the way that biblical scholar Holtgren puts it. He says, simply point to the all-encompassing and thorough impulses of the divine mission. No area of possible habitation is to be left out. When you read this parable, there's this moment in it where it's obvious that God goes, hey, everybody's to be included here. This banquet that I have been preparing since the beginning of time is for everyone, and no one is to be left out. This is for everyone. That's why he sends a servant, go out everywhere. Probably also why Jesus talked about us being his witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Go, go, because this banquet is for everyone. At this point, the meal ends, but the chapter continues. And at first I was wondering, wait, what? Why didn't they break the chapter right there? Because it's obvious what happens next is the next part of the story, because it says, large crowds were traveling with Jesus. I go, wait, why is this included in the 14th chapter? Because it's obvious the first part's all been around a table in a Pharisee's house, and now he's out traveling with large crowds. Why is this included? Listen to the first paragraph in this next section. It says this, large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Now, quick word on a literal interpretation of the Bible. Sometimes I hear people go, we need to just interpret the Bible literally. Well, be careful. Because if you're really committed to this idea of we need a literal interpretation of the Bible, then you now have grounds to hate your wife. And that's not Jesus's point here. Jesus is using hyperbole to drive home a bigger point. He says, if you want to be a part of what I am doing, if you want to be a part of what God is doing, it's going to be difficult. You're going to need to be willing to give up everything to be part of what I am doing, because what I am doing is reaching out to all people, and that's hard to do. In fact, you're going to need to be willing to leave everything that is comfortable and known, have to be willing, and pick up your cross, the ultimate sign of pain and humiliation. You need to be willing to do that if you're going to really be my disciple. And we must always remember, whenever Jesus starts talking about picking up our cross, we must remember that we have to be like Christ, who took up the cross so that all could have a place at the banquet. When we hear Jesus say, hey, you need to be willing to pick up your cross and follow me, we have to remember that Jesus actually did. He picked up a cross, and he did so because people are important. And he's going to make sure that nothing needs to come between the opportunity for all people to dine at this banquet. He was going to go to great lengths, to make sure that everybody had a place at the table. People are important to God. And if we are followers of Jesus, then people need to be important to us. People are important to God. So people are important to us. You read through the 14th chapter, and again, it's like, guess what? People are important. They're important to me, God says. And if we're going to be followers of him, then guess what? People need to be important to us. Now, you might be wondering, okay, wait a second. Who are these people that you're referring to? Who are these people that I need to be caring for? Well, the people you need to be caring for are the people younger than you and the people older than you. The people that like the same music as you and the people that listen to music that you think is noise. The people that dress funny, which probably includes you because everybody thinks somebody else dresses funny. The people that have different political conclusions. The people that have different religious conclusions. Your neighbor, your coworker, your family member. Those are the people. Every person that you come in contact with, those are the people that God through Jesus said, those people are really, really important to me. If they're really important to me, then they should be really important to you. This is why, as a church, we take 3-2-1 so seriously. If you're not familiar with 3-2-1, this is all it is. Each one of us should be able to identify three people that we're already in relationship with that are currently not following Jesus. Our job with those three, love them, bless them, care for them, learn their story. And if they ever ask about your story, you're willing to tell them. Identify three people. I should be, if you're a regular attender here, I should be able to come up to you on any Sunday morning and go, who are your three? And you should be able to go, boom, boom, and boom. People are important. We recognize that God has already put us in relationship with people, and so we want to be intentional in that direction. Three, identify two people that are currently following Jesus that you are discipling, that you are mentoring, that you are building into, and identify one person that's building into you. People are important to God, so they're important to us. That's why we do 3-2-1. People are important to God, so they're important to us. That's why we give so much attention to Parker Whitney Elementary School, because the teachers over there are important to God, which means they're important to us. The students over there are important to God. That's why they are important to us. The parents of those kids are important to God, and so they're important to us. That's why we want every one of you to find concrete ways to bless them. CJ mentioned it earlier. We are attempting to adopt every teacher at that school. And if you haven't already, if you go out right after the service, you can sign up. It's a very, very concrete way for you to be able to pray regularly for a teacher, encourage a teacher. We get to do that because those teachers are important to God, which makes them important to us. Who are we supposed to care for? People. What then shall we do with them? You say we're supposed to care for them. I need an action plan. How do we step into this caring for others mode? I'll give you two suggestions. First is this: humble yourself before God. That's a great first place to start. Humble yourself before God. Going before God, going, God, guess what, God? I might be really good at some things, and I've accomplished some other things, but at the end of the day, I'm a bit of a mess. And I don't have what it takes to care for that individual as well as they deserve. I don't have it within me. On my best day, I don't have it within me. God, but you are God and I am not. I'm gonna humble myself before you. And then the second thing is to humble yourself before others. Quote I wanna share with you before I move there. John Nolan writes this: the one who comes to God must come humbly, recognizing his own poverty before God. God will not turn him away. That's the beautiful thing. If you humble yourself before God, I think it just makes the heart of God smile in a very special way. But after we humble ourselves before God, humble yourself before the people, recognizing that they are really, really important. They're more important than our traditions. They're more important than my likes and dislikes. They were created in the image of God and deserve to be loved lavishly. Next Saturday, I'll be up in Washington doing a wedding. And at this wedding, well, I'll say the same thing I say at every wedding I've ever done. Weddings don't impress me, anniversaries do. I say that at every wedding I've ever done, and I'll say it this Saturday. Weddings don't impress me, anniversaries do. But then we'll talk about, in this wedding on Saturday, what it's gonna take to get from the wedding to an anniversary and from an anniversary to anniversaries. And this Saturday, Josh and Brittany are gonna be there. And as we talk about this, I'm going to look at Brittany and go, you know, Brittany, we get some of our instructions about marriage from the book of Ephesians. And in the book of Ephesians, this is what it says about being married. It said, wives, submit to your husbands. Not real popular language these days. But I'm going to look at Brittany and I'm going to say, hey, just because we have difficulty with it doesn't mean we can ignore it. It says, wives, submit to your husbands. And I'm going to look at Brittany. I'm going to say, it's just in your mind, what is the physical position of submission? Is it not down on your knees? And I'm going to look at Brittany. I'm going to go, that's exactly what you should be doing before Josh. And I'm sure Josh is just going to be beaming at this moment. I love this wedding ceremony. I'm not looking pretty. No, that's what you're supposed to do. Kneel before your Josh. I go, unfortunately, this is the part in the passage that we usually shut the book. He goes, no, I don't think so. I go, you got to keep reading. Because I'm going to look at Josh. I go, because the next verse is really important. It says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loves the church. According to the Gospel of John, at what moment did Jesus show the full extent of his love? If you answer on the cross, you'd be theologically correct. However, in the Gospel of John, the moment that John says that Jesus showed the full extent of his love was in the 13th chapter of John when he was in the upper room where he washed the disciples' feet. And I'm going to look at Josh and go, what is the physical position of foot washing? Is it not? I'm going to look at these two that are getting married and say, this is what a marriage is supposed to look like. Two individuals down on their knees, trying to outserve the other. Show me a couple that looks that way. I'll show you anniversaries. Show me a couple where one is on their knees serving, the other is standing. I'll show you a statistic. What then shall we do for the people around us? We get down on our knees. We humble ourselves before God and before them, and we serve them. And we serve them, and we serve them. One of the Greek words for love is agape. Best definition of agape I've ever heard is to intelligently and intentionally do what is best for the other person. This is what we do. We humble ourselves before God and this person, and then we try to do what is exactly the best thing for them. And we keep doing it, and we keep doing it, and we keep doing it, and it's hard. This is why Jesus said, pick up your cross. This isn't going to be easy. It's going to be hard. Anyone that knows me knows that I am a movie person. I love movies. One of my all-time favorite movies is Field of Dreams. Also happens to be one of the most misquoted movies of all time. I'll show you what I mean. Finish this quote. If you build it, they will come. Too bad it never says that in the movie. If you build it, they will come is not what the voice says. It says, if you build it, he will come. The story of Field of Dreams is all about the reconciliation of a relationship between Ray, played by Kevin Costner, and his estranged father who died many years ago. If you build it, if you are obedient, if you sacrifice, he will come. And so Ray Kinsella plows under a portion of his cornfield, builds a baseball field, and magically out of the corn comes these old baseball players like Shoeless Joe Jackson. And towards the end of the movie, Ray, played by Kevin Costner, is getting so frustrated because he has sacrificed so much and he doesn't see what the benefit is. And he's looking at Shoeless Joe Jackson and he says this, I did it all. I listened to the voices. I did what they told me. And not once did I ask, what's in it for me? And Shoeless Joe Jackson responds by saying, what are you saying? What are you saying, Ray? And Ray says, I'm saying, what's in it for me? And then they have this conversation. And finally, Shoeless Joe looks at Ray and says, if you build it, he will come. And at that moment, he looks over, and there taking off the old catcher's equipment is his dad. The younger version of his dad. It's at that moment that this relationship is restored. When it comes to humbling ourselves before God and others, it's hard work. It's digging, you know, it's plowing under our cornfield and sacrificing much. And it's hard work. But there's this moment, you go, guess what? If you do it, something beautiful happens. Because people are important to God. And when they become important to us, something wonderful happens. We start building something of substance, and suddenly we get reunited with the Father in a very, very beautiful way. We start walking in his steps again. And relationship is restored. Throughout the 14th chapter, Jesus says, here's how I want you to do it. And by the way, if you do it, you'll be blessed. It's the better way to live. Because if you do this, he will come. And you will experience the presence of God in powerful, powerful ways. And at the same time, the people at Parker Whitney and the threes and your neighbor and your coworker will get to see the hand of God at work. And that's not a bad thing. Would you pray with me, please? Lord, you are good and your mercy endures forever. And for that, we give you thanks. We thank you for your word. We thank you that it is alive and applies to us just as much as it applied back then. Father, we thank you for the reminder that people are important to you, and so people need to be important to us. God, give us the humility and the courage to follow in your footsteps, the humility and courage to pick up our cross and follow you, to have the willingness to sacrifice all for the benefit of the people around us. May our knees be calloused because we spent time praying and spent time serving. And we pray this all in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.